Okay. Well, I was a very young Christian, probably my first year of my Christian life. And one lunchtime, I met two fellows. One was German, one was from the south of England. And it was a particularly memorable talk with the English fella. They both fought in the war. You were two guys, who Christians now, who've been on opposite sides. And you was about 40-odd years later. And the English fella told me this, that the battles were particularly fierce where he was, and that one by one he noticed early in the morning soldiers were rummaging for a Bible. It was great in the Premier Inn last week. They still got Gideon Bibles. Some of the hotels are banning them, but they still got them. Praise God for that. So this English fella said that he went rummaging. He knew there was a Bible somebody had given him, and he found it in the end, and he was panicked. He was scared. He could see whites of everybody else's eyes. They were afraid. And he rummaged through the Bible, and he flicked, and he found Psalm 91, where his eyes caught sight of verse 7, 1,000 will fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, it won't come near you. And then, of course, he went on to verse 9, if you make the Most High your dwelling, no harm will befall you. And he wasn't a Christian, but he was trying to recite these like a mantra, you know, like a good luck charm, like a talisman. He went in the battle that day, and soldiers fell either side of him dead. And a bullet skimmed through the back of his neck. He showed me this long scar. All he needed was stitches, you know. And 40 years later was this long scar, as if almost like somebody skimming stones across a river, you know. This long scar with a bullet that just skimmed all the way across. No damage, but, you know, just stitches. But what was thrilling, why I've never forgotten it, was he said then, I called out to God then, not just to keep me safe in the battle, but to save me. And the Lord, in his mercy, saved him. But how many Christians died in battles like that day? They had the verse. Hadn't they called out for God to keep them safe? You know, perhaps we'll come back to that. We're back in Romans 8. And, you know, it's hard in Romans 8. Romans 8 is packed full of good things. And where to stop, you know, where to start even. But I've tried to contain myself tonight to this passage. In Romans 8:17, we have Paul saying now that we're joint heirs with Jesus Christ. Don't you realize what's happened? He says to these Roman Christians, we're joint heirs with Jesus Christ. If, he says, we're willing to suffer with him. And then the verses that follow, there are three groans. My title tonight is Three Groans, One Glory. There are three groans here. First of all, in verse 22, creation groans. Creation groans. And not just a faint little moan, as in childbirth. I don't know much about it. I was there, but it looked pretty painful for where I was standing. Serious groaning. And why is creation groaning? Because it was never meant to be like this, how it is now. Occasionally you find people argue over the age of the earth. Even Christians argue about, is it so many million years old or billion years old? Is it so many thousand years old or whatever? And whenever we are about to go into an argument like that, we need to remember there have been two catastrophes. Number one, the fall of Adam and Eve, the fall of man, which affected everything. Everything, you know, walruses, wombats, everything, you, me, everything, flowers, everything's been affected by the fall. Nothing is the way it ought to be. Then the second catastrophe, there was a flood, a worldwide flood. You had water spurting up through the rock layers. Everything is a shambles now. Creation is in a state of frustration, we're told here. You sometimes hear this thing, or I used to hear it when I was a kid, God's in his heaven, all's well on the earth. But there's a sense in which that's not true. God is in his heaven, but all is not well down here, is it? You know, way last week, watched a program, one of those cooking programs, Stand Up for Cancer, I think it was called, Stand Up to Cancer. And one of the stories they showed, this family, the little boy had cancer, and it looked as if he was in remission, and he died. The mother had been in remission, then she died, and now there's the husband with his daughter, you know, and the poor dad's heart is aching. And I was just thinking, what a world we're in, man. What a world. And then they went from this horrific story, tragic story, to a commercial which is about expensive kitchens and cars. And I just thought, yeah, that's our world. Oh, that's awful, but never mind, have a new kitchen. Never mind, have a new BMW or whatever. Don't you feel anything of the frustration that creation feels? When creation must look at people who, you know, here we are tonight, there's a possibility of a world war, isn't there? What are most people doing? Oh, put it out of your mind, isn't it? But there's other groaning. In verse 23, we groan, Christians groan, creation groans, we groan. What are we groaning for? For glory, longing for glory. Have we ever longed to get out of this cesspit that we're living in? Long for glory? Well, we have the deposit, we have the guarantee, but there's glory. We're not sure even what it means. We're way out of our depth. We groan because we long to be there. Do we? Do you ever long for glory? Do you know anybody? Have you ever met a Christian who would longed for glory? You know, again, the saying is, you can be too heavenly minded to be any earthly good. Have you heard that? What a load of codswallop that is. If you look at history of our land, how many Christians have done tremendous good, earthly good, because they were heavenly minded? People like Wilberforce. He only wrote one book, I think. It wasn't about slavery, it was on the gospel. The most effective Christians in this world are people who are fixing their affections up there, not down here. Somebody said this, hold your earthly treasures. Have a think what they are now, your earthly treasures. Hold them lightly on the palm of your hand, so lightly that when they've gone, you barely notice. Now that's big, big stuff. Somebody else I read last week said this, you know, they built the golden cow in Exodus 34. Moses destroyed the golden cow. And this is what this writer said then. We can't even be bothered to build a golden cow. We just use whatever's handy. Oh, isn't that true so often? We can't even bother to build an idol. We just have a look around for something that's near, don't we? So creation groans. Paul says the Christians groan. But then, verse 26, the Holy Spirit himself groans. There are times we're not quite sure what to pray for. Or perhaps we can't even pray. There are times when you're so devastated, you're not even sure what to say. He intercedes. He, likewise, the Spirit also helps in our weaknesses. We do not know where we should pray as we ought, but the Spirit himself makes intercession for us with groanings that cannot be uttered. The Spirit himself prays. I remember when I was a very young Christian, I did some work with a lovely guy called Geraint Fielder, who was in Abergavenny and down in Highfields at the time as well. And there was this wonderful story. He'd been in a prayer meeting in North Wales. Everybody was agog, North Walian. They all spoke Welsh. They all spoke Gog Welsh. And it came to the time of prayer. And he said, look, your first language is Welsh. You know, you pray in your first language. They all prayed in Gog Welsh. He didn't understand a word. He sat there. But he wanted to pray. And he prayed. And afterwards, some of the Welsh-speaking brothers said to him, it's amazing, see. You didn't know what we were praying, did you? No. But he prayed exactly the same. The Spirit, you see. Spirit interceding with groans. He didn't even know what they were praying. But the same Spirit that was inspiring their prayers was moving his own heart and his lips. So three groans. But that doesn't mean we're to be miserable people. We're to be realistic. We're not to be optimistic. We're certainly not to be pessimistic. Oh, there we are then. Because if you're in Christ, something amazing has happened, isn't it? Something stupendous. Nevertheless, our Savior was a man of sorrows. We sung it earlier on. He was labelled a man of sorrows. He wasn't a miserable. He wasn't a spoiling, sort of spoilt every party. Just the opposite, in fact. But nevertheless, he was serious, wasn't he? We're to rejoice in God, rejoice in his blessings and the gifts. But we're to groan for glory. We're to groan for Jesus to get glory here in our lives, in this little fellowship, on this hill, in this city, in our land. We're to groan that the earth will soon be filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. We are to groan. But now, my text, I think, if I got a text at all, is verse 18. For I consider, says the apostle, that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. I consider, says Paul. I've weighed it up, he says. I've thought about this a lot. You know, I remember a program some years ago, History of Christianity in Wales with Hugh Edwards, and he was very keen on the weighing scales, you know, to get into heaven. Your good deeds ought to outweigh your bad. I assume everybody here knows that's absolute nonsense. They can never. You can't do it. Even if you could say, well, I got 65%, like that I saw a rabbi interviewed on American TV some years ago. Well, as long as you've got 65% good deeds and leaving only 35% bad, well, you'll be all right. That means then we've got 35% evil in heaven. So it's not heaven, is it? It's this, isn't it? We know surely that salvation is God coming down and saying, you can't do it. You can't make 65%. You can't make 6%, actually. But even if you could make 65, it's nowhere near good enough. You need to be 100% perfect. You need to be holy. You need to be clean. You need to be pure. And you're not. So I'll do it for you, which is what the cross is about, isn't it? So that he will take the blame for us. So that we would be set free. The spiritual exchange, the swap. I dump all my filth on him. He gives me his righteousness freely. But Paul is using a weighing scale illustration here. I've weighed it up, he says. I've considered. I've weighed these things up. And there is a weighing involved. You think of, it's over 50 years now since a teenager called Johnny dived into a lake. Broke the bones here. Been no feeling below her shoulders since. What a tremendous witness she's been. The power of grace. I remember, can't remember exactly when, but just after the year 2000 it was, somewhere around there, I went into one of those pound shops and they had three diaries out of date, like, you know, from 2 years earlier, three diaries for sale. Reduced, fair play. They'd reduced them in the pound shop. They weren't even a pound. It was three for a pound or something like that because they're useless, aren't they? They're out of date. I thought, oh, that's a great idea. I'll buy those. And I decided then, any time the Lord really spoke to me, not just, oh, yeah, that's interesting, but really spoke to me, I would write it in one of those diary entries. And I found one of them the other day. And I took it away last week, and I looked at it. And there were two verses I'd written from Hebrews 11. One of them was... all these, is a list of people in Hebrews 11, were still living by faith when they died. And the second one was the world was not worthy of them. And I'd written those down just before a lovely lady we knew, young lady, died in her 30s. And those two verses just seemed to be what the Lord was saying, you know. She was still living by faith when she died. And the world was not worthy of people like her. You think of Johnny Erickson, over 50 years in a wheelchair. Still living by faith. Do you remember that day, some of you do, that day that she spoke about, where she's sitting by her window in her chair and... obviously, she's got the urine bag, and it bursts. She's covered in urine. She's wet. The smell is uncomfortable. she feels again pathetic. She can't do anything about it. And she's sitting there, and this verse comes into her head from 2 Corinthians, light and momentary troubles. And she says, Lord, light and momentary. 40 odd years, I think it was, in this chair, light and momentary. And then the Lord speaks to her from this passage from Romans 8. These sufferings are not worthy to be compared with the glory that will be revealed. That's it. In fact, Corinthians passage says, these sufferings are achieving an eternal glory that far outweighs everything. That's my honest assessment, says Paul. I consider it. I've weighed it up. This is reality, he says. Maybe you haven't seen it, Roman Christians. I've seen it. I've seen this. This is there. This is reality. It's going to be revealed. It's there now, but you can't see it now, he says. It's not something that's suddenly going to happen. It's there. The glory of God is there. But one day, he says, it's going to be revealed. These present sufferings, when he's writing this, what sufferings is he talking about? Not a hernia and a slip disc, is he? You know, there were Christians at this time being set ablaze as torches in Nero's garden, or being ripped apart by lions in the gladiatorial arena. Like today, you know, banged up in Eritrea in a steel container, or in a concentration camp in North Korea. These present sufferings, Paul says, I know, they're awful, but they don't compare with the glory. But they're terrible, though. Yes, they are. But they don't compare with the glory. The glory's there now, and one day it's going to be revealed. Now, somebody told me a story, I think it was last week or the week before, of somebody who was incarcerated in North Korea, and the guard was beating this lady, and because he said she was a Christian. She didn't know what a Christian was. She was in this camp. He was beating her because she was a Christian, and she decided, if she was ever going to be released, to find out what a Christian is. Because she was being beaten and she didn't know who Jesus was. But wonderfully, when she was released, she eventually defected, I think, to China or something, and she was converted. How wonderfully the Lord was working there. She genuinely could say to him, I have no idea what he's talking about, but he kept on beating her, convinced that he was doing good. So back to Psalm 91. As our terrified soldier, no harm will befall you. In what sense is that true? Can I say that to you tonight? No harm will befall you. That's what it says in here. If you're living for Jesus Christ, if you make the Most High your God, no harm will befall you. In what sense then? You're safe forever in the arms of Jesus. Oh, but you will have to suffer. Not might. You will have to suffer first. You will. I received an email recently, a chap called Conrad Mbewe, who's a well-known preacher in the UK and America, but he's from Africa, and he was grieving over what's happening in the big churches in Africa. He says there's a prosperity gospel, health and wealth. Nobody should be ill, and no suffering. And he was grieving, first of all, he says, because it sidelines the real gospel, and secondly, because it's a lie. And it's a lie. It's clear in the Bible. You will, everyone who wants to live a godly life, Paul says, will be persecuted. Not maybe, not possibly suffer. Everyone will. Do you know anything of this? Jim Packer summed it up. The Christian life is cross-country all the way. That's it. Maybe if you want a question to talk to somebody about afterwards, perhaps that's something you could ask or think about. Perhaps it's too personal. You know, what do you know of suffering for Jesus' sake? Not suffering because you're a pain in the neck and somebody doesn't like you, but suffering for Christ's sake. See, the world is a hater of Christ. The world hates him. He told us it did. It would. And if you strive at all to live for him, you will have to pay a price. You have to. Because the you and the world will clash head on. No matter how nice you try to be, if you were trying to live for Jesus, sooner or later, We heard about condemnation and so on this morning. Sooner or later, the world will accuse you of being judgmental because your standards are much too high for the world. Now, I read in Psalm 92 last week, they still bear fruit in old age. Oh, and I couldn't help asking, Lord, do they? How many old people do I know, Christians, I mean now, who are still bearing fruit? Not many. Most Christians, you know some of them. Perhaps you are some of them. They settle down long before middle age. You know, they get a nice job and a nice house and a nice car. Perhaps they got a family or whatever. And they settle down. And their spiritual potency just slips through their fingers. You know it, don't you? You've seen it. You know, we had a lovely student on the camp years ago. And she came up to me and she said, you know, I've been away to college. I met some charismatic Christians. They're on fire. She said, I'd never met anybody on fire. My parents are not on fire. My pastor's not on fire. The elders and deacons are not on fire. My friends are not on fire. And she said, yeah, that's it, isn't it? So she hadn't met anybody remotely on fire for God. You know, within months of me being converted, maybe 7 or 8 months, and not, thank God for a non-Christian I was working with who came to me and said, oh, I'm so glad you've settled down. I thought, right, that's it. And I said, thank you. That's breaking my heart. And she said, I'm sorry. I said, no, it's not for you to apologize because you're right. For some reason, what is wrong with me? I am settling down. I went in the charity shop last week. I went in loads. And there was a sign on them. I don't know what he meant, but I know what I meant. Don't just fly, soar. I don't know what they were selling. But I just thought, yeah. That's God speaking to me, that is, and to you. So, you know, I was listening to Piper on John 12. Now is the time for judgment, says Jesus, you know. Now is the time for this the prince of this world to be driven out, to be cast out. And Piper asked the question, cast out of where? What a great question. And his simple answer was, when we stand in the courtroom, before the judge of all the earth, the judge of all the earth says to the devil, get out of here. Get out of here. This has all been sorted. Throw it out of court. I thought, what? That's tremendous, man, isn't it? That's enough to make you sore, isn't it? You know, you think of, as Tom was preaching this morning, you know, do you feel guilty? Who doesn't feel guilty? But to know that it's all got dealt with, isn't that tremendous? Remember Hebrews 11, some were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. What's that about? Some faced jeers and flogging. That's probably the worst we'll ever know is jeers, people making fun. People slamming the door on you or whatever. And then chapter 10 of Hebrews. They joyfully accepted the confiscation of their property. Because they knew they had better and lasting possessions. They knew just around the corner was glory. Glory. Do you remember the story of Lord Carnarvon and Tutankhamun and Howard Carter eventually found the tomb, wasn't it? And then people looked at Carter and he was depressed. His head in his hands. And they said, why aren't you excited? He said, because, he found the tomb here, he said, because 17 years ago, I dug there. And he realized all those years. You know, he dug there. He could have found it then. He was that close. And do you realize how close you are to glory? Won't be long. Won't be long. You know, when my friend was in hospital here, and I visited him on the Tuesday, he said, they've just said there's nothing more they can do. The remission is over. That was Tuesday. Friday, when I visited him in Cardiff, he's dying. You know, bang. You know, is that close to glory? I didn't realize within 72 hours he'd be in glory. I remember going to a funeral of a very well-known preacher and a lovely guy. Talked about the Christian who had passed away. I'm sure now, he said, he's strolling up and down the streets of heaven, chatting to all his mates. And I was just thinking, right, But why isn't there a mention of Jesus here? We chat to people down here. Okay, some of them have gone ahead of us. Okay, but we've chatted to people before. Surely the best thing about heaven is another dimension. Can't we at least contemplate glory? He's there. If he's not there, you know, I just felt, you know, are we going to looking forward to a heaven? It doesn't matter if Jesus is there or not, because we'll see our old mates. Is that enough? You know, there was a lady in the first church we were in, young lady, and her mother died when she was young, I remember. And she came to church, and when, you know, she professed faith or whatever, why did you come to church? I want to see my mother again. Oh, I understand that. But surely, if we're saved, surely there's another dimension. You know, think of the Commonwealth Games that's just been. I didn't see much of it, but those won gold medals, you know? All the years of pounding the track or pumping iron, all the strict diets or whatever, and they stand on the rostrum with a gold medal. Oh, it's worth it. It's worth it. When all their mates were saying, oh, come out, let's go for a curry, and they think, no, I got to stick to my diet. I got a big thing coming up in 6 months or whatever. It's worth it now, isn't it? You know, I visited, I know I told you something before, a dear Christian who was dying, living in Matlock, he was at the time. And, you know, there was no doubt, spiritually, his bags were packed. He was ready to go. He had a family. But he was just like Calvin, you know. Calvin said, live every day with one foot raised, ready for the off. If God says, today's the day. You know, any idea about this? Glory, glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. Now, I know there are two obvious forms of suffering. There's, first of all, denying yourself. It hurts, doesn't it? It hurts. If you decided, I'm going to give up this, I'm going to give up this TV program, I'm going to give up chocolate, I'm going to give up whatever it is, give up my hobby, whatever, to follow Jesus. Of course it hurts. It's denial. But then there's the suffering of losing friends. For Jesus' sake, losing popularity, being labeled odd, not because you're a real weirdo, but odd because you were more enthusiastic about Jesus than everybody else in churches. You know, Basilea Schlink, tremendous name, German Christian, godly Christian lady. She led a little group of ladies in Germany in the 1940s. And then one night, the city was flattened by the Allied bombers. She had all these people professing Christians. And she said, our city was flattened in 18 minutes. And she said, before those 18 minutes were up, all those professing Christians knew exactly where they stood. Now it was on the edge of eternity. Now they really sorted out who's there and who has no confidence at all. I had an email from a Christian organization last week telling me how regularly the Queen tells everybody that she's just trusting Jesus. She never told me. She told you? Doesn't come across? Does that come across? I thought, why is a Christian organization latching on to something that the Queen... It's not obvious to me. Do I need the Queen's testimony? Don't think so. See, you all, everybody here just about says they believe. And yet, you know, we sit next to people who we are not sure believe, and to put it crudely, we watch them drown because we can't be bothered to get our feet wet. Isn't that right? Think of this morning. People here this morning didn't believe, came in, went out, as far as we know, unbelieving. Did anybody say anything to them? You know, some of you will remember in the late 80s when the communist bloc started to fall apart and the wall came down and so on, and all those students were demonstrating in Czechoslovakia, and they were being hammered and beaten with truncheons and didn't want to go back on the streets. And one little bit of paper that was circulated to every student in Prague changed everything. And all it said was, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? And out they went. Oh, they were beaten, some of them. But it brought everything down because the sheer net volume of people. And surely, if you're a Christian, who else is going to turn the tide? Look at our land. Who else is going to turn the tide? You know, Tom Daley saying he's concerned that 37 Commonwealth countries wouldn't welcome him because he's gay. Is that the big issue, Tom? Have you looked at what's happening in the world? Who's going to turn the tide back? If not you and me. They don't know the truth out there, do they? Or perhaps you sit there and say, yeah, I know, but I'm hopeless, really. Are you? That's a good place to start, isn't it? I remember going to a big church to preach, and there was a guy I hadn't seen for about 15 years or something, and after I preached, he came up to me and he said, oh, I'm so pleased you've mellowed. And I said to him, have I? Oh, yeah. And, you know, my heart sank. I thought, yeah. Oh, you were happier. You were happier. But, oh, you know, I was reading the Charles Simeon. He was a pastor over 50 years in Cambridge. He was converted as a student, and then he went into the church. He had horrendous problems. You know, there was a time when they locked the pews. They had their own pews, and they had the rich. They paid for. They locked them because they didn't like his message. He preached to people standing in the aisle. And he carried on for over 50 years. He was attacked in the street. They, sometimes tried to barricade, stop everybody getting in. He went through all that. They sometimes interrupted the services and tried to disrupt. And somebody said to him after about 49 years, how have you kept going with all this trouble, with all this struggle? This is what he said. When I was a boy, he said, and I try and clamber through a hedge, I knew if I could get my head and shoulders through, even if my legs and body would get bruised, scraped, and scratched, I knew I could get through because my head and shoulders were through. And then he said, my Jesus, my head, has gone through all that suffering so that I can be sure I can get through. Does that mean anything to you? Do you follow it? Yes, I'm hopeless, you say. Don't you believe that this God can take hold of you and change you? Call on him. Keep banging on the door. Call on him. Give him no rest. Give yourself no rest till he comes.